Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now it's time for a monthly visit from New York City Council Speaker Corey Johnson. Mr. Speaker, welcome back to WNYC.
Always happy to be here, Brian.
And listeners, like with our Ask the Mayor segments, we can take your calls for City Council Speaker Corey Johnson on anything in the five boroughs, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Speaker, can you react to Governor Cuomo's statement, and we're going to do a separate later this hour on it, but speaking against Trump's Make America Great Again slogan, that false nostalgia, when Cuomo said America was never so great, we'll reach greatness when stereotyping and discrimination are gone. Obviously, he's getting a lot of pushback for saying America was never so great, saying it with that tone of voice.
Well, he may have been inartful in the way he said it, but I think the most important thing to acknowledge here is that Donald Trump's Make America Great Again slogan came out of Donald Trump championing birtherism and questioning our first black president's ability to be president. And for many people, Donald Trump saying make America great again meant make America white again. So to have a president who has not upheld the rule of law, who has questioned our intelligence agencies, who has pushed on societal norms and pillars of a democratic society, to be lecturing the governor on these things in the aftermath of this is really appalling. Again, the governor may have been inartful about it, but I think for many Americans who still experience poverty, who still experience discrimination, and where there's still massive economic inequality, we are a great country. We're a great city. We're a place of dreams and aspirations, but we can be even greater. So you can be great and be greater. I think that's what the governor was trying to say, but we shouldn't let Donald Trump off the hook. Look, for him, make America great again, I think he means let's make America white again.
Remind us, have you endorsed in the gubernatorial primary?
I did. I endorsed Governor Cuomo.
And Cynthia Nixon said this was another example of Cuomo trying to figure out what a progressive sounds like and missing by a mile. That's what she tweeted. How much do you agree with that?
You know, I think he was inartful in the way that he said it. I think what he was, I can't speak for him and I haven't discussed it with him, but I think what he was trying to say is for many Americans, whether it be women or African Americans or immigrants or LGBT people who still are experiencing injustice in America, they may not think things are so great right now. But he clearly said it in a clumsy, clunky way. But there is some merit to him saying we still have a long way to go to have full justice in America, though I believe we are a great country, we are a great city, but we can be even greater.
And to stay on electoral politics for a minute, you are endorsing in this primary season challengers to the so-called IDC Democrats in the state Senate, those eight who help Republicans maintain control of the Senate. They say the IDC is over and they are supporting the mainstream with a regular Democrats leader, Andrea Stewart Cousins, for majority leader now, and what could be a unified vote. Stewart Cousins and other Senate Democrats themselves are endorsing these IDC Democrats for re-election in return. Why make waves and even threaten that deal by not joining the peace circle?
Well, to say that the IDC is dead, it's like Night of the Living Dead, the TV show, or like Frankenstein who comes back from the dead. Fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, shame on you. Fool me a third time, shame on all of us, because they have said this before. We need a progressive Democratic majority in the state Senate. They have played footsie and collaborated with the Senate Republicans for almost a decade now. They've been about self-interest and less about the interest in their constituents in the state of New York. So I'm really proud to endorse the challengers. Last night I was door knocking with Alessandra Biaggi up in Riverdale, and she got a great response on the doors.
Running against the IDC leader, Jeff Klein.
That's right.
And you even retweeted yesterday, I noticed, something that happened after this show on Tuesday. Jessica Ramos, who's running against IDC member Jose Peralta in Queens, tweeted something like you just said. We've seen this movie before. In 2014, they said they had disbanded, and then they came together again. vote them out. Now, Jessica Ramos was reacting to this on our Tuesday show from political analyst Ozzie Pabura from the podcast FAQ NYC about the IDC. You'll hear Ozzie refer to his podcast co-host Christina Greer as Chrissy.
It's unclear, and anyone who's ever walked into a high school cafeteria knows you can tell students we're all in the same class, we're all together, and every now and then you recognize patterns of certain kids sitting together. And there may be something where they don't openly, as Chrissy Greer said, they don't openly call themselves an IDC, but there may be an instance where somebody walks out of the chamber during an important vote, which has happened before in Albany many, many times. So there are ways that people can informally align themselves. Sometimes they do it for regional purposes. Lawmakers on Staten Island, oftentimes, even in different legislative bodies, they share an interest in representing that borough. You may see former IDC members not dropping their independence after Election Day.
So using a school cafeteria metaphor, I guess Ozzie was saying the same thing of you. As you, the question remains a question. Even if they disbanded the IDC today, will it remain disbanded when it comes time to elect a Senate Majority Leader in January?
I don't trust it. And I listened to the segment the other day, Brian, that you had. You called it a nerdy, wonky, geeky political insider segment with Ozzie Pabura and Christina Greer talking about the genesis of the IDC, its creation, and the individual races. What I would say on this is, again, there is too much at stake for the state of New York. And let's give one big example of what was just referenced in that segment of people walking out of the chamber during a vote. Earlier this year, there was an amendment that was put forward to fully fund the Campaign for Fiscal Equity, billions of dollars owed to New York City so that children could have a sound basic education in our public schools. And the eight members of the IDC walked out of the chamber. So instead of voting for the amendment, they walked out of the chamber so they wouldn't have to cast a vote, even though their districts are owed tens of millions of dollars. That showed me everything I needed to know.
New York City Council Speaker Cory Johnson with us. And let's go on to some big news items from council in recent days. The Uber cap. Were you surprised at the amount of pushback on civil rights grounds?
No, I wasn't surprised. I think that it's actually a very legitimate concern, and I don't think we should discount this really awful past of racial discrimination of black and brown New Yorkers not getting picked up when they're trying to get a street hail. So to me, it's a totally legitimate thing. I just don't believe that the action that we took is going to bring us back to those bad old days or exacerbate a problem which still exists in parts of the city. We're not diminishing service. We're not taking 4-hour vehicles off the road. What we're saying is, let's study the issue. There are 100,000 4-hour vehicles on the road right now. And one of the things that our bill does is over the next 12 months, it sets utilization rates. Right now, Uber, Lyft, Via, Juno, they're empty 40% of the time. They're full 60% of the time, empty 40% of the time. We want utilization to go up so that the cars are filled more often, which it actually helps service and wait times across the city. And so we don't believe it's going to have a deleterious effect on pickup service or folks that use this industry. And Uber and these companies have met a need. They met a need for the outer boroughs. They met a need for folks in New York who couldn't get the street hail. And I use Uber, so I'm not anti-Uber. We just thought they shouldn't have unfettered, unlimited growth without any regulatory check.
We have a question coming in on this, so let's take it. Henry in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi there. Well, Mr. Speaker, I first want to say that I appreciate what you and the council did with this FHV legislation. But what I wanted to ask is, and this is something that you kind of mentioned during the process, is what next steps would look like. Because to me, these reforms are welcomed. I think they're great ideas, but I personally don't think that they fix the problem. So what would you say is the next step for the New York City Council making sure that this industry is more equitable.
Thank you, Henry, for the question and, of course, for the call. So what the bill does is over the next 12 months, it gives the Taxi and Limousine Commission the authority to do a series of things. Number one, set a minimum wage for drivers, which ends up being about $17.22 after their driving expenses. Many drivers are struggling. We've seen 6 tragic suicides over the last 7 months. Number two, again, it sets up a study and an implementation for utilization rates. We're going to get quarterly data every 3 months from Uber, Lyft, Via, and Juno that will go to the TLC. We will analyze that data, and we left a few exemptions in there because we don't want to impact service in parts of the city that needs it. Number one, if there's a geographic area of the city, I'm just naming a random neighborhood, Soundview, Jackson Heights, Bed-Stuy, that these companies can prove needs more service, they can get more cars on the road. We also left an exemption where they can put as many wheelchair accessible cars on the road as they want over the next 12 months. So we want to study the issue, create utilization rates, and try to figure out what the right number is. Is the right number 100,000? Is it 120,000? Is it 80,000? Is it 150,000? We don't know yet, which means we're going to work with these companies to figure out what that number is.
I was actually wondering just last night whether the exemption for accessible vehicles, that is vehicles you can put a wheelchair in, basically, might wind up to be a gigantic loophole. Because I think that's the requirement for all future yellow cabs. Is that accurate?
It's about to go up to a 50% requirement.
50% requirement. And I don't know the money involved, the extra investment for a driver who wants to go into the Uber or Lyft or Via or Juno business. But if it's not that much, what you might see is a continued proliferation of these cars, but they're all going to be accessible.
Well, we need more accessible cars on the road. Right now, out of the 80,000 vehicles that are associated with Uber and 100,000 vehicles that are on the road, you have less than 1% that are accessible. So if you're someone who's in a wheelchair or who has mobility issues and you try to order it on the app, it either is going to take a very long time to come or it might not come at all. So we actually want more accessibility. There are hundreds of thousands of New Yorkers who need this type of service. So this is, I shouldn't even call it an exemption. It's an incentive to get more of these vehicles on the road.
So really, and again, I don't know the finances involved, so I don't know how prohibitive it's going to be to this kind of outcome. But if we see after a year of the study that you launched, that instead of 100,000 of these cars on the road, there's actually 120,000 of these cars on the road, massive increase, but they're all accessible, would you consider that a success or a failure?
We'd have to see what the impact is. Part of what we're trying to do is really be data-driven. So over the next 12 months, every 3 months, we want to look at the data, we want to study it, we want to work with the Taxi and Limousine Commission and the companies and the drivers, Uber drivers, yellow drivers, green drivers, to figure out what the impact is. But let me say one thing on the cost issue, Brian. The report that came out a few months ago that was commissioned by the Taxi and Limousine Commission from James Parrott and Professor Reich from the University of California at Berkeley, they put forward a number, which Uber hasn't disputed, which said that last year in New York City, 1 year, 2017, Uber brought in $375 million in revenue with only $575 million in revenue and $50 million in expenses. They made hundreds of millions of dollars in profit. They're valuated at $70 billion Uber. Lyft is valuated at $15 billion. They could subsidize drivers to put these type of vehicles on the road if they wanted to.
And it's been interesting to see the commercials that Uber is running now. It's like those Wells Fargo commercials for their bank and Uber, the similar commercials like, we're changing our culture. We're going to be nicer in the future. We're going to be a better public corporate citizen in the future. Well, so they're on the defensive.
Well, let's not forget that all around the world, municipalities in the United States and London, Paris, you can name places around the world, there were many issues before this new CEO came in of them lying to regulators, giving misleading data, doing things with users' data that really gave them a black eye. And so they're trying to rehab their image during this time as a kinder, gentler, more honest Uber.
Janet in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with City Council Speaker Corey Johnson. Hi, Janet.
Hi. Hi, Speaker Johnson. I'm so glad that you are now the head of the council. I am among the people who testified when you were running the hearing about large exotic animals in circuses in New York. And I was so moved by you at the time when you shared with us your personal feelings about going to the circus as a kid and how it was thrilling and also left you feeling sad when you left because of the plight of the animals. So I have high hopes that you will be the first person to take effective action to protect the carriage horses in Central Park. The driver owners, I think, the industry has a great more shadow than substance. I have met these guys. I'm Irish myself. I know that they are thugs who are exploiting the animals. And all you have to do is see one of the carriages with the horse nose to tailpipe in traffic and know how inhumane their circumstance is. It's 18th century New York.
Janet, let me jump in for time. But this is one of the great unresolved issues of the de Blasio administration. He ran on ending the carriage horse business, and that was 5 years ago now. I believe city council has been the obstacle. Where are you on this?
Well, Janet, first of all, thank you for those very, very kind words. And I'm really proud that we passed that bill when I was chair of the health committee on circus animals and exotic animals. And I'm a big animal lover and champion. I have a rescue cat who's my roommate, Moose, who I adopted from animal care centers in East Harlem.
You have a cat named Moose?
A cat named Moose, spelled like M-O-U-S-S-E, like chocolate moose, because he's fat and sweet. And my first job when I was a teenager was I took care of horses, 35 Dalmatians, 2 miniature donkeys, and 2 llamas. So I wanted to be Dr. Doolittle when I was growing up. I didn't want to be a politician. So I love animals, and I want to be a champion for them. Let me just say a few things, and I want to respectfully disagree with you, and I know we both say this in the spirit of loving animals and wanting to take care of the horses. I do not believe that the mere act of pulling a carriage is inhumane. If you walk to Central Park South, we want to make sure that the horses are taken care of. But if you look at them physically, they do not look malnourished, and they don't look like they have behavioral problems. But there is an issue of wanting to ensure they are safe in traffic, that they don't get spooked, that they are not surrounded by buses and trucks. And so the idea of moving them into Central Park so that they're protected from that is something that I don't object to. But I do not believe that the mere act itself is something that is inhumane or is dangerous to the horses. And so, we want to ensure that these animals are protected. An interesting statistic, if it's true, that I heard recently, which is in the last few years, over 100,000 horses were shipped from the United States to Canada for slaughter because they're so expensive to take care of. We do not want to see horses get slaughtered. We want to make sure they're taken care of in a humane way here in New York City. And there have been issues with the heat index, making sure that horses are not out in the heat. And these are things that I think are legitimate and we should look at, but I don't support an outright ban.
Janet, thank you for your call. As an animal lover, I see you tweeted the photo that someone took that's been going around of a seal that showed up on a rock in the Spuytendyvil Creek in Inwood.
In your neighborhood.
At the top of Manhattan. Quite a sight from Manhattan.
You know, it actually says something, I think, about the health of the rivers around Manhattan, the fact that we are able to see more life. There was a report recently about a huge number of oysters that are finally found in the Hudson River. They were wiped out almost 100 years ago. And so it's good to see, because you have good organizations like Riverkeeper and other organizations that are looking after the health and environment of our city and the rivers.
But you know that seal was there because the rock was rezoned for seals making at least 160% of AMI. Kidding. But on the Inwood rezoning, was this the most controversial one out of the various ones around the city to allow, you know, higher-rise development in exchange for a certain percentage affordable? Out of all the ones, was this the most controversial one that you passed last week? I know there was the big demonstration at City Council Chambers.
Yes, it was. It was the most controversial. I was the most controversial because, you know, I think that what you could tell from hearing from folks who live in Inwood who came and testified and who were engaging in civil disobedience, both at the city council and in the lead up to the vote, that Inwood is considered one of the last affordable neighborhoods in Manhattan. And there's a lot of concern about displacement and gentrification. An interesting statistic is that average rents across the city were rising. I think you asked Mayor de Blasio this the other day, in the mid 20% average around the city in neighborhoods, and in Inwood in the previous year went up to 38% of where it was rising. I think one of the big
starting lower,
and one of the big concerns is about preferential rent. The Inwood has more apartments, rent regulated apartments, than anywhere else in the entire state of New York, and the issue is, how do you protect from these massive increases that landlords could impose? Right. I was arrested a few years ago outside, inside the state capitol, protesting, wanting to strengthen the rent laws. And I hope we have a progressive Democratic majority to close the loopholes on the rent laws and get rid of these totally unacceptable preferential rent loopholes that exist. We need to re-regulate apartments, repeal vacancy decontrol, and that would protect the neighborhood of Inwood in a significant way.
From the pressure to raise those below stabilized rents. How do you know, though, that you're not just giving real estate developers a new edge into, or wedge, really, into gentrifying the neighborhood with those high rises, even with a percentage of affordable housing that's guaranteed?
It is a great question. I think there are concerns about secondary displacement, which means that what you just said, if you build something in a community, even if you're building a certain percentage of affordable housing, what's not to say that you're not going to get pressure, which will incentivize landlords from driving up the rent and pushing other people out. I think the issue here is we were afraid, Councilman Rodriguez was afraid, the mayor was afraid, that if you did not act, you were going to keep seeing pressure and pressure and pressure build on its own. And their belief was to put forward a plan that would create 2,600 new affordable apartments, preserve 2,500 existing affordable apartments, and do significant investments in parks, in schools, in the waterfront, access to the waterfront, all of those areas. Clearly, that wasn't enough to satisfy a significant number of people in Inwood. And what I think it shows is that there is massive anxiety all across the city, not just in Inwood, but in other places, about rezonings.
And we've just got a minute left, but I want to stay on this because of the precedent that it might set for the rest of the city. One of the aspects of that deal is a kind of commercial rent control for the local businesses that would be on the ground level of those new apartment buildings. I think it's 10 years of limited rent increases that the landlords would be allowed. Of course, you know, businesses around other neighborhoods are clamoring for something like this, with the crazy skyrocketing commercial rents in various places. Do you see this going broader?
I would hope it would go broader, but again, it's very...
It's up to you guys.
Well, no. What I mean by that is, this circumstance is it's a very narrowly tailored and focused limited amount of buildings that would qualify for this. It's buildings that are getting HPD subsidy, Housing and Preservation Development subsidy of a certain amount of money. So it's very narrowly tailored. We have a small business crisis. I have said in the past that I support the Small Business Job Survival Act. The city council will have a hearing on that bill this year. We want to resolve the legal questions that have surrounded it and make sure that we can do something that is legal and would pass potential challenge, which we think would happen. And so we are sorting through that. And that bill would protect a huge number of businesses around the city. In my own district, you walk on Hudson Street or Bleecker Street in the Village, on 8th Avenue or 9th Avenue in Chelsea, on 10th Avenue or 9th Avenue in Hell's Kitchen, empty storefront after empty storefront after empty storefront. We have to do something here.
New York City Council Speaker Corey Johnson, thank you so much. We'll keep talking.
Thank you, Brian. I'm very, very sad about Aretha Franklin.